earnings have been fantastic. It hasn't done anything for the stock market because we're in overheat mode with a 3.7% unemployment rate.
It was a stronger than expected number this morning for the third quarter, but in the words of Oxford Economics, it contains some, quote, spooky details. There appear to be a lot of noise from tax cuts and tariffs that may not mean slower growth ahead, but could mean different growth as some of these distortions work their way through the system.
Wall Street's October sell-off grew more intense Wednesday, with the Dow plunging 608 points and turning negative for the year. One day after the Dow staged a 400-point intraday recovery, the index gave way again, sinking 2.4% to 24,583.
Between the Fed and the trade war, we're in rough shape. As algorithms act like machine guns, mowing down stocks indiscriminately, taking no prisoners, none. Today was the first day in ages where the market not only ignored legitimately positive earnings surprises, it actually punished them.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Sell, sell, sell. That was probably the big news hitting the markets this week, as the entire rally from this summer and all of the gains of this year have been given back as a result of selling this week. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in hour one will be Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray. He said one of the things that he's still looking for is that final washout that happens in a market, a complete capitulation. So was that this Friday? Was that a fake out or a breakout? And he does expect a relief rally into the end of the year. Internals of the market have gotten weaker. That's one thing to keep your eye on. But he still thinks that by the end of the year, we hit 2850. You want to hear why. But he has the same concerns I have, a trifecta that could weigh on the markets and the economy: a rising dollar, rising oil, and rising oil prices. And also the cracks we're starting to see, not only in the big tech names, but also what is occurring in emerging markets. Does that create the next financial crisis? Also, later on in the program, Dan Steffens from Energy Prospectus will be joining me. He thinks we're going to settle in that $67, $65 oil range for the rest of the year. Oil markets, he thinks, are very tight, and I agree with that completely. There's a lot coming up here in the oil markets, and you know what? The sanctions take place on November 4th against Iran. That could take nearly a million barrels off the market. There's also a new maritime law that goes into effect in the year 2020, when sulfur emissions on seagoing ships will be reduced from about 3.5% down to 0.5%. That could remove a million barrels off the market, not to mention the problems that we're seeing in Libya and Nigeria, and also a lot of those hedges that a lot of these companies have put into place, which have maintained oil at lower prices. A lot of those hedges are coming off. Could we be facing higher oil prices? Dan seems to think so, and I agree. Also, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about all those events moving the markets this week. All of that coming up in hour one.
And coming up in hour two, Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray is still looking for a final washout. Was Friday a fake out or a breakout? Also, are the internals of the market getting weaker? By the end of the year, we expect to hit 2850. Listen to find out why. Also, rising oil prices and what is occurring in emerging markets. Does that situation create the next financial crisis? Also, Dan Steffens from Energy Prospectus and the oil markets. Are we facing higher oil prices? Don't forget, sanctions against Iran take place on November 4th. What impact will that have? All of that's coming up in hour two of the Financial Sense News Hour. Well, Ryan Poplava is here to share with us the drivers and catalysts that moved the financial markets. Now, Ryan, it was another volatile week for equities around the globe and here in the U.S. as well. That may be an understatement. But the S&P 500 closed down 3.9%, the NASDAQ closed down 3.78%, and the Dow Industrials closed down 2.97%. Now, Ryan, we're in the thick of earnings with a bulk of information technology, communication services, and consumer discretionary sectors that are reporting this week. Is there still growth? And in your opinion, what led to the weakness?
Chris, we've had about 48% of the companies in the S&P 500 report by now. And yes, we do have growth still. 77% reporting have beat on estimates, and 59% of companies reporting have beaten on revenues. Now, we started the earnings season with year-over-year growth estimates around 19%. Now that we've had, you know, almost half of the S&P reporting, those actual results, because they're beating, are driving earnings estimates higher. So the blended, so that's actual earnings plus estimates still to come, right now we're at 22.5% growth in earnings year over year. That's the third highest growth rate since Q3 of 2010. But in this business, it's not just important to beat estimates, but you know, we need to be guiding higher. We need to look, what do we have around the next corner? What do we have to expect? And if you look at what we've seen here, there's been a lot of reaction to that this week, and not in a positive way. On that note, you know, looking at some of the noise this week, some of the companies did beat and raised guidance like Boeing and Intel, but many too have reported higher costs and shrinking margins like Caterpillar. Now, Thursday, we rallied in a very big way. It was like it was almost the first attempt really to kind of claw back from just the real huge weakness we saw on Wednesday. That was Microsoft, Twitter, Union Pacific, and ConocoPhillips all beating on earnings and driving prices higher. But we ended the week on a sour note. Unfortunately, at the end of that day, Alphabet and Amazon reported earnings that while they beat, they guided lower and they did miss on revenues. So Amazon posted specifically almost $5.75 earnings versus consensus expectations for $3.11. Now that was a huge beat, something like 80 something percent or another, but they did miss expectations for revenues by almost a percent. Now Google also beated by $13.06 versus $10.45. So that's a 25% beat, but they missed on revenues by almost half a percent. Now, unless your earnings are perfect, obviously some of these high PE stocks, they just get taken to the woodshed. So that's what happened on Friday. We opened up down. But interestingly, I was looking at the New York Stock Exchange's FANG Index, and many of those reported this week. So we had Netflix, we had Google, we had or Alphabet, and we had Amazon. And of those, what's interesting to find that while there were two that were very bad towards the end of the week, that index actually closed flat on the week while the rest of the market was really down. So that to me was a very interesting metric to be following.
Well, Ryan, thank you for the earnings update. It sounds like that's really a key point in the ongoing question that's on investors' minds. But I do want to ask, do you think we've hit peak growth?
Well, Chris, let's take a look at some really key areas right now that might be driving that sentiment. Chip stocks. We've been talking about chip stocks since, I think, July. We're one of the groups that have been missing, and as one of those groups that we're watching for those kind of growth signals, because a lot of them are very leading in that. When we make semiconductors, what are they used for? They're used for many, many, many other products. So they're at the very front end of that chain. So Texas Instruments warned it's seeing a slowdown in demand for its products across most of its markets. And that led to a 6.7% retreat in the VanEck Semiconductor ETF. Now, AMD, which has been just a real performing darling this year, lowered guidance. But despite their warnings, the semiconductors actually rallied strongly on Thursday because what appeared to be a buy the dip. You know, when you see negative reactions in the market and the market's up, they're basically saying, oh, the worst is behind us. So that's interestingly what we saw from a reaction to AMD stock. Now, if you recall earlier, a few weeks ago, I reported that Intel was increasing its CapEx by $1 billion. And that's a pretty bullish move to make for a company in what may appear to be an industry that's slowing. They said they're not slowing. So they came out with earnings, they beat, and they've guided higher. So semiconductors were weak this week overall because the whole entire market was weak. But there were some interesting developments for the group, with the group up despite AMD's warning, followed by a strong print from Intel. Now this week, the new home sales for September were down 5.5% month over month, when expectations were only for a dip of 0.6%. So that was a huge miss for housing, and that really affected the housing stocks this week. So it does appear from some of the charts that we follow that housing is definitely slowing. It's hard to say if we have the long-term top here, but it has definitely slowed. And whether the storms that we've seen on the East Coast, so flow, et cetera, you know, how much is that playing into that? That still could be a possible factor. So we'll have to see if things bounce back over the next month. But definitely chalk up housing as a decelerating growth, a possible red flag on the growth for the economy. And finally, on growth, the advanced third quarter estimates for U.S. GDP came in around 3.5%, which beat expectations. This is the first estimate. You know, we'll have follow-ups to that. But half of the growth, if we're taking a look at the specifics of the announcement, attribute the growth to inventory buildup. That was half. The other half was as a result of spending, which was up a robust 4%. In fact, the strongest since the fourth quarter of 2014.
So again, it sounds like earnings really were a big driver this week, Ryan. Was there anything outside of earnings in the world of news that was driving sentiment?
Last weekend, China cut taxes on its citizens, which drove a big rally on money and equities, and that followed the strong rally Friday due to the People's Bank of China speaking very strongly about backing up company financing and calling equity prices essentially below what's fundamentally there and should be true. And they made good on that this week by planning to give China Bond Insurance Company $10 billion to provide credit support for private financing. Now, the other item that was this week, there were a bunch of Fed speakers. Also, the European Central Bank met on Thursday, and they left policies unchanged, which has led some to believe that the ECB will decide maybe in December whether to completely end QE or possibly extend it. They have acknowledged that they've seen a slowing in growth. We did get the flash purchasing managers index information on both the US, which actually ticked up, and Europe, which ticked down. So they were acknowledging slow growth, but they believe currently still it's only transitory, although we keep seeing that tick lower and lower. So we'll just have to see what we'll see in December. Acknowledge the weakness there. On Italy, they acknowledge that there's got to be some diplomacy there, but they're not willing to move one iota regarding Italy's debt and rising rate problem there. Of course, we talked last week about Spain, but that was more Spain-centric with some of the banking issues there in how they're reclassifying, mortgage taxes. But leaving the ECB, as you and I sit here, we're still waiting for Standard & Poor's to rate the Italian bonds. Last week, Moody's left Italy's outlook stable, but gave it a notch downgrade to B. And that caused a nice rally in Italian bonds and equities. Italy responded to last week's official letter from the European Commission, basically asking for clarification on some of the items. And Tria said he knows they're not complying with the rules, but he's hoping to have what he called constructive conversations. And I put that in quotations about it. So he wants to have talks and see if the bar can be moved a little bit for their specific needs. We'll have to see. That's a big fight. So all around, we're seeing a lot of diplomacy issues. The globe over, the US and China, they're going to meet at the G20 later in November. The UK with its Brexit, still a lot of steps there to be taken. And then, of course, the EU and Italy, and et cetera. So a lot still going on there that's affecting the macro and that's affecting global currencies and global interest rates. Now, the advanced GDP release, we already mentioned that, and weak housing data, that's really, I think, the key drivers at the end of this week.
Well, Tria is not the only one having constructive conversations, Ryan. We appreciate the constructive nature of our conversations with you about the markets. We look forward to having you in the studio next week. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
Disruption is exactly as Clay Christensen has defined disruption. You know, it is that classic technological, low-cost, high-volume player that comes in at the bottom of the pyramid of a market and just eats its way up the food chain. You know, a classic example of that in transportation is, of course, Uber and Lyft and ride sharing. And often, by the way, disruption, one of the key markers that I think is interesting about disruption is it's often a model that had someone told you at a cocktail party 6 years before it happened, you would have been like, no way. There's no way people are buying other people's garbage directly from each other online. There is no way that a stranger is going to get into another stranger's car and pay them for that ride. Like, or I'm going to put my kids in that car. I mean, it's just not, it's just, these are models that are technologically driven, that eat their way up the food chain, and are typically, in a way, a model that no one would have thought of as even remotely palatable or sociologically palatable.
Should you buy and hold at market tops? At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe valuations, leading economic indicators, and other metrics are essential for prudent investing to both identify long-term opportunities and to minimize risk. Every day, we keep a watchful eye on the markets, continually assessing the investment landscape so you can focus on the things that matter most. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk. Give us a call at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, a registered investment advisor.
Well, the autumn storms have finally arrived. After a nice record high set in many of the indexes in the month of September, most of those gains have been given back. Joining us on the program is Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray. Craig, what's going on in the market here on the day you and I are speaking this Thursday? The Dow's up about 300 points, maybe making up for half the losses on Wednesday. But is this just a bounce from an oversold rally, or is something more serious starting to happen here?
Well, Jim, thanks again for having me back on the show. I always appreciate it. And where I think we are with this market is our last publication we put out in September, we were talking about, is this going to be a fake out or is this going to be a breakout? As we're starting to see the popular averages move the new highs, we were unsure at that point in time based upon the internals of what we were seeing with our work, Jim. So from our perspective, what we're seeing right now here today on Thursday is just another little relief rally. There's a lot of challenges out there that we've got to really take into consideration with these markets. And as I just look at the markets here in the U.S., which most of the listeners care about, I would just make the following observations. We made a marginal new high in the September timeframe. We've now corrected almost 10% on terms of the S&P off of the highs. And the internals of the market have gotten weaker ever since the beginning of this year. Back in January, Jim, when we were on the show, we were talking about how these stocks in the markets were going parabolic. They were due for a correction, and parabolic charts typically end one way, they end poorly. And certainly that played out in February and went through a rebuilding process. But now at this point, I think it's going to take some more time. The internals are very weak. And as I look at my internals, Jim, kind of intra-week at this point in time, it really suggests that we are approaching levels. One of the key indicators that we'll look at is we call our 40-week technique, and it measures how many stocks are simplistically above their 200-day moving average. As of this morning, Jim, only 19% of our groups and the market are still above a 200-day moving average. Now, you may say, that's great. We're getting closer to the washout point. But what we've historically seen is that when you get to this level, there's one more final washout that takes place, and you end up in a kind of a single-digit type reading on that particular indicator. I view the price action we got right now as just a relief rally. That break below yesterday, below the 2,700 level on the S&P, suggests that, yes, we're going to start another leg lower. And I think you'll find support probably coming in at around 2580, 2500. And Jim, that matches up with the uptrend support line we've seen off the 0809 bottom. We touched that uptrend support line in 11. We touched it again in 16. I think we're going to touch it again here before year end.
Craig, when you start to see a rotation into things like utilities, staples, and healthcare, is this usually what you expect to see towards the end of a bull market, or is this just simply a risk-off trade?
And I'm sticking with what we've said since 2012. The next secular bear market's not coming until you get to a 5, 6% 10-year bond yield. And again, we're not near that at this point in time. This, to me, is a healthy correction and a reset and a retest of the uptrend support line at this time.
Craig, something that we saw in the February downturn, and we're certainly seeing here, and you just made reference to it, and that's the risk-off trade. Typically in the past, in this bull market, whenever the markets went negative like 2011 or went negative at the beginning of 2016, there was a commensurate rally in the bond market. We did not see that in February, and we're not really seeing it today where you have the 10-year Treasury still at above the 3% level, almost 3.14 or 1.2. What is that telling you about interest rates, that the Treasury market isn't reacting as it typically has in past corrections?
Well, as I look at the bond market, I also want to take into consideration, you know, how flat the curve is at this point in time. And as I look at how flat this curve is, we're kind of sub 30 basis points between the 2 and 10 spreads. You know, historically, that has been a precursor to some sort of weaker economic period in the future. The fact that we're not seeing any sort of rally in bond yield at this point in time suggests to me that when all asset classes typically become very correlated, you're entering some sort of period where you don't really get the diversification that we've been looking for or seeking between bonds, equities, commodities, currencies. And usually in that kind of final phase move, everything kind of resets. And perhaps that's the meaning of what we're seeing now. So to me, it suggests that action like today is just a relief rally, not the end. And it's not yet, in my viewpoint, a tradable bottom. So I'd be sitting on my hands waiting for that final flush out versus trying to step up and pick points at this point in time.
Now, one area that has done well has been technology and consumer discretionary. They've been some of the biggest leaders within the S&P. They're looking like they've been starting to break down. If we do reach that flush out point and come back, do you expect these sectors to lead the way back up?
You know, I think the market is going to stick with growth. So the short answer to your question is, yeah, I think tech is going to come back. I come back and I'll look at some of the FANG stocks, and you look at some of the names that have done very well, the Amazons and Netflix. Facebook and Netflix specifically look a little bit weaker and look like they're testing some very important support levels. So tech is going to be, I think, still a very sought after play.
I want to talk about another market that is in a bear market. And then, Craig, that is, if you look at the emerging markets since the beginning of the year, they're definitely in bear market territory, being down more than 20%. How much of an influence are international markets having on here? Obviously, we have a trade war. The Wall Street Journal is talking about manufacturing companies complaining about rising cost as a result of the tariffs. You've got basically the rhetoric between the U.S. and China. That hasn't been resolved. You've got problems in Italy with their budget. How much of what is going on overseas, how much of that will find itself on our shores?
All right, Jim, I think that question is spot on the mark with what we're seeing in the marketplace and where a lot of the concerns are. When you look through all the markets in Europe, you look through all the markets in Asia, and even in the U.S., you'll quickly see that most of the markets in Europe, most of the markets in Asia, they're off kind of high single digits to mid-teens. So the question comes down to, was the U.S. going to ultimately drag up the rest of the world, or was the rest of the world going to start to lean on U.S. equity markets? And I think the latter has been the case, that we're seeing the European markets wane, or I should say, weigh on the U.S. markets. And specifically, Jim, I'd call out a couple things. One, you mentioned emerging markets. For me, I'm confused as to why you'd want to step up and buy emerging markets. Yes, they sold off, but I think it's going to be challenging to see the emerging markets work here for a while. Second, in terms of the European markets, arguably, DAX is the German market, and the DAX is one of the biggest markets in Europe. And you look at that chart, it's a clear head and shoulders top that has been made in the DAX. So from our perspective, there's still going to be more shakeout in that German market. And I look at it and I would say you probably have, you know, 9 to 10% of the downside before you find your lows on that. Moving over to Asia, and you can see that the uptrend support line on the Shanghai composite has been recently violated. And that uptrend violation goes all the way back to 1996. So that's a pretty meaningful uptrend violation that has occurred.
Craig, let me talk about a trifecta. And something that may either impact overseas, eventually impact us here, and that is rising interest rates. We know the Fed is going to raise probably in December a couple times next year. We've had rising oil prices, even though they pulled back recently, and a rising dollar. So if you look at that trifecta, a rising dollar, rising interest rates, and rising oil prices, sooner or later, that's got to hit somewhere.
Jim, you're spot on correct. And you've hit on, so far through this discussion we're having here today, we've touched on international markets. We've talked about the weak internals of the market. We're talking about rising commodities. We're talking about a bond market that is seeing a very flat bond market at this point in time. I mean, all these pieces together, and if you spin that together, even with a financial sector, Jim, that is just really not participating, you're really looking at meaningful headwinds, and you have to ask yourself a very simple question. What are we playing for at this point in time as we move into, you know, the ninth year of this, you know, this secular bull market? Clearly, you can have some pauses and corrections along the way, and maybe that's what we need to see, similar to what you saw in 11 and what you saw in 16. But yeah, these are major headwinds, Jim, that I don't think investors should ignore.
You know, the other thing too, Craig, when you hear these press conferences accompanying an FOMC meeting, the Fed chairman is talking about, you know, how well the economy's doing and the labor markets. And it's a very sanguine, very optimistic outlook by the Fed. It seems to me like they ignore one of the reporters basically asked him in a press conference, when do you stop? In other words, when do you keep raising and realize you've gone too far and things are starting to break? And one of the areas that's breaking, Craig, is what we're seeing in the international markets, because there's a lot of debt denominated in dollars. At some point, you would think the Fed would say, wait a minute, we could have a crisis on our hands.
One would think that that could be a reaction that the Fed would have, but the Fed has got a focus that is more on the U.S. than it is on international markets at this point in time. And again, that's kind of the policies that are being kind of mandated out of the White House at this point. So all the cracks are there as you start looking at the mosaic and the weight of the evidence between the international markets, the weak internals, the interest rates, the rising prices of commodities. You never know how this is ultimately going to manifest, but clearly the writing is on the wall. The cracks are there. You can't ignore it. Again, I'd come back, Jim, and I'd say not many people saw the downturn in 2007, 8, and 9. You know, you saw cracks out there like you see now. You didn't know how far it was going to be from kind of peak to trough, but you saw the cracks. And that's the beautiful part about the technical analysis that we do, is that you start to see the cracks, you start to see these intermarket relations start to look like challenges, you start to see the DAX tops, the breakdowns in the Shanghai composite, the flat yield curve, and you start assembling this together. And it really helps you understand the mosaic of the risk reward that you have in the market at this point in time. And I would just say for equities right now, again, we're not bearish, but we're definitely in some sort of corrective phase. It's going to take longer to work out. And at this point in time, I would say 2,500, 2,580 is probably an area where you could see this shake out. And by then, our indicators are going to be in very washed out condition.
Craig, usually when you see a washout in the markets, you know, going back to February this year, where in 6 days, the markets lost 10 to 12%. And, you know, if this isn't the final washout, we could be there again. In other words, we could be seeing two corrections of 10% or more in a single year. That usually takes time to repair itself. Talk about the psychological impact, because I could just see it on investor sentiment. It is, you know, this has scared a lot of investors.
You know, the hard part is I fully appreciate investors being scared. We're 9% off the highs at the bottom of the market. We could have bought the S&P at around 665. So, I mean, there's huge gains out there. I think people are going to be somewhat quick to protect those. I also think that, you know, the growth of the ETF industry, while that's great that we've moved to some passive money, it's become such a large part of the market, that will probably kind of lead to faster sell-offs along the way, because no longer are you just selling one stock, you're selling multiple stocks when some of these ETFs get sold. So, you know, again, from my perspective, I appreciate the concerns and the shakeout, but put it into context. If we're at some sort of trade dispute, trade war, take a look at China. The Shanghai Composite is off more than 30% from the highs. I could only imagine the sentiment here in the States, if you put it into perspective, to have one of the other biggest economies in the world, China, and their Shanghai Composite off 30-some percent. So I'd never like to see pullbacks like this, but I think we also have to level set our expectations that this market can go two ways, can go up and it can go down. And that's why we do need active management, why we do need advisors to help steer us through these kind of waters. You can't just put it all into ETFs and call it a day.
Well, listen, Craig, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the great work you do at Piper Jaffray, tell them how they could do so.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. They can send me an email at craig.w.johnson@pjc.com, or they could certainly reach out to their one of their terrific Piper Jaffray sales representatives.
All right. Well, listen, Craig, thanks so much for coming on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
You too.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
The retail public has not been in. They've been listening to this, oh, higher interest rates, oh, the market's going to crash. It's all we've been hearing actually since 2009. The vast majority of these analysts have been bearish all the time. This has been the most hated bull market rally in history. We're nowhere near a high yet. When you get at a high, it means like 1929, they talk about people who basically just shine the shoes are buying. We're nowhere close to something like that. So this is not the euphoria where the little guy's in. Retail participation is still half of what it was in 2007. So this is not a major high.
Well, if you're a consumer, there's a little relief coming at the pump as the price of oil pulls back. But is it pulling back permanently, or is it about to head higher and higher to levels you wouldn't believe? Joining me on the program is Dan Steffens from Energy Perspectives. Dan, I want to start out with an article that was in Wednesday's Wall Street Journal, and it said oil bears' teeth look a little blunt, and they were talking about the traders overreacting to headlines. And it says, what they're not looking at is oil demand in the two largest consuming countries, the U.S. and China, still look strong. Iranian sanctions aren't going away. So they're saying unless global growth slows more sharply than is currently forecast, global oil supplies will be tight well into next year. Let's pick up on that in the pullback that we've seen in oil and where you think it might be heading.
Well, first of all, I think oil got kind of caught up in the market sell-off. You know, when you have a big drop in the market like that, that everybody's convinced the global economy is going down, which would be softer energy demand. And so oil pulled back to a support level. There's been strong support this whole year at 67. And there's even stronger support at 65. I'm using 65 in all my forecast models, but I do think oil's going a lot higher. And yeah, as they said there, the oil market is very tight. I mean, there's none of the OPEC countries really holding back any production at all. In fact, two-thirds of them never held back any production at all. Neither is Russia. You know, now on our production growth has kind of stalled since June. We've been, you know, pretty flat on our production. So yeah, we're headed to a very, very tight market in 2019. Now, oil demand is seasonal to some extent. So the third quarter, actually September and October, are kind of soft demand periods. And then as the first cold waves of winter start rolling into the northern hemisphere, you get an uptick in demand for heating oil. And that's where we are now.
You know, three things that kind of strike me. Number one, you've seen a sharp drop in production in Venezuela. It's been much greater and faster than most people believe. Number two, Dan, Iranian export cutbacks are not going away. I mean, that goes into effect next month. And number three, something that you don't hear too many people talking about, and that is the International Maritime Organization's 2020 sulfur regulations that are going to change diesel fuel that is being used in, 68,000 ships that transport goods across the ocean. Nobody's talking about that. And those things aren't going away and are likely to be more pronounced as we head into next year.
Yeah, we can go through. Let's go through each one of those. First of all, the near-term thing is on November 4th, the full brunt of the sanctions against Iran go into effect. And actually, the U.S. Treasury Secretary was interviewed last weekend on Reuters. He said they're still going for zero exports. I don't think it'll go to zero. You know, they'll figure out ways to smuggle oil out and stuff. But already, just leading up to the sanctions, Iranian production has dropped by 700,000 or 800,000 barrels a day. When the full brunt of that goes in and everybody quits exporting, it will drop to over 1 million barrels a day from where they were. If it goes all the way, if it would go to zero, you're talking about 2.5 million barrels a day less supply on the market. There's no way OPEC can make that difference up. Then in Venezuela, they have dropped like 1 million barrels a day from where they were 2 years ago, and it continues to slide. In fact, I saw an article this morning of how the president, Maduro, he has been stealing gold out of their treasury and moving it over to Turkey. So guess what he's going to do? The country is in total meltdown. They're not paying their bills. Schlumberger and the other, you know, big oil fields, international oil field service companies have pulled out pretty much, so they can't fix anything. And I have seen some articles that say that their production may actually go to zero, exports may go to zero. They're now at about 1.3 million barrels a day. So if let's say half of that goes off the market, that's another big deal. But this IMO 2020, and for your listeners, IMO is International Maritime Organization. And this rule has been voted and approved by almost all the countries in the world. And what it means is the ships that travel the oceans of the world can no longer burn high sulfur fuel. To give you an idea of how big of a deal this is, the pollution from like 10% of the world's ocean-going vessels, more pollution from those ships than all of the automobiles in the United States put together. That's how severe it is. So this is a big deal. And it's going to be implemented. In fact, they had a meeting just yesterday where several of the members argued that there's not going to be enough low sulfur supply and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But they still voted to implement it. I think there will be enough supply. There would be little regional shortages, and they've got some mechanism to get a little waiver. If, you know, if they're in a port and they can't get the fuel, then, you know, they can get some kind of waiver, short term waiver. But it's pretty much going to take about 2 million barrels of supply off the market. It goes into full effect on January of 2020. So, you know, we're only like 15 months away. So that's a big deal. But when you add these three things up together, there's just no way current supply can meet that demand unless there's a big increase in price, which, you know, refined products to curtail demand growth. And so that's where Raymond James put out a new forecast the other day, and they raised their oil price forecast by $10 a barrel for the coming years.
You know, Dan, I want to talk about another issue that the traders, I think, get focused in the wrong way, and that is oil inventories. As you mentioned, we're in the shoulder months of the year when seasonal demand is soft. Mm-hmm. Refineries are in maintenance mode, so they're consuming less. But the other thing is, when you look at inventories, the relevant figure in inventories is days of consumption in terms of supply, because we're burning a lot more oil today, consuming a lot more oil. So when you look at the gross inventory number, that really doesn't tell you. What you need to do is translate that into how many days of supply. And we're getting down into roughly about 28 days and to the 26-day level, which is a very critical supply.
Yeah, it's critical level. And the one to look at distillates. Distillates is diesel, primarily diesel and heating oil. It's like down into the low 20s. It's really low. I was just looking at the charts this morning, and the only thing that is above the five-year average on days of supply is gasoline. It took a big step down and just is barely above the five-year average. Everything else, including crude oil, jet fuel, distillates, you name it, it is below the five-year average.
And I want to throw two other factors out there. Well, let's begin with one, which sent the markets down a little bit this week, and that is Saudi Arabia saying, you know, they're going to ramp up production. You know, Dan, I've been watching this oil market for at least four decades now, and I have yet to see Saudi Arabia produce 12 million barrels a day of production. Now, they say they can go 12 and a half, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's a number that if you step back and like, yeah, they could, if they went out there and drilled a lot of new wells and built a lot of new infrastructure. And the thing is their infrastructure, their, you know, their gathering, their storage, their ability to load the oil onto ships is all really based on about 10 million barrels a day. Now, you may have seen reports recently that they exported 12 million barrels a day. Well, exports and production are two different things. And the Saudis do, think of Saudi Arabia as an oil company. And they want to, you know, have adequate supply to meet their customer demand. So they store oil all over the world. They have floating storage. They have storage in Japan and, you know, other areas. And so when their customers want it, they can deliver it. Because the last thing you want to do is, oh, well, we can't deliver it. So then they turn to Iraq or they turn to Iran to buy their oil. So Saudi wants to keep their market share. So, yeah, for in a very short term, they can increase exports, and that's what they've done. And frankly, I think it's kind of a geopolitical thing. They're now doing it to appease Trump and, you know, pre-election whatever. That's it. But as far as increasing their production to 12 million barrels a day, that could not happen overnight. It's the same situation we've got in the Permian Basin where production got up to our pipeline capacity, and now it can't grow anymore until they build new pipeline storage, gathering, processing, all that. It just can't grow anymore.
Yeah, and that's something that people forget about infrastructure. When you get into the oil business, it's not like a factory that produces widgets where you flip on the switch and you produce more widgets. I want to talk about other swing producers, like you take a look at Iraq, Libya, and Nigeria. And Dan, there has been instability in the production of all three countries. So you have terrorist attacks in Libya. 1 month, they're down a couple hundred thousand barrels of production because there's an attack. And then the next month, they're back online. Same thing with Nigeria, where they're, you know, disrupting the pipelines. Who knows what's going to happen there? And then also with Iraq, where you have political things. So, you know, the world cannot say, like, if you look at Russia, maybe you look at the United States, and you look at Saudi Arabia, those are the big three when it comes to oil production. You're talking about almost 30 million barrels or more coming from those three countries alone. But outside of that, where else are you going to get an increase of supply? I just don't see anybody out there that can come online and say, well, if Saudi can't do it, we can step in. I don't think there is anybody.
Well, I will tell you right now, they're all producing flat out. There's nobody holding back any production right now. The only ones that it looks like can increase production for 2019, there's only like four countries, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, UAE, and Kuwait are the only four OPEC countries that really have any, you know, more than 100,000 barrels a day of potential to increase production. The rest of them don't even have any potential. There's half of the OPEC countries are on decline. That's what people don't realize. You know, Nigeria, Libya, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, they're on decline, and Venezuela, big decline. And then with the stuff against Iran, it's just, you know, if we're turning to OPEC, expecting them to bail out the world's oil market, it's just not there anymore.
I want to talk about something that has been difficult all year for the oil sector. The Wall Street Journal just talked about taking a look at the six largest Western oil companies. We're talking about Exxon, Royal Dutch, to the BPs. They're on track, Dan, this year to generate $90 billion in excess cash. But if you look at that, you know, investors are just shunning these oil companies that, you know, when you talk about the price of oil being up 30-40% from where it was a year ago, that's translating into bigger cash flow, bigger earnings for these companies, bigger sales. But it seems like the street is ignoring it across the board. I don't care wherever you look in the energy sector, it's really hard to find companies that are doing well, even though financially they're doing well.
Yeah, financially they're doing well. In fact, I was working on Range Resources last night. Their actual realized prices for the third quarter are way below where we are now. Their earnings per share beat first call estimates. Their cash flow from operations is very strong, more than enough to meet their capital program. They're increasing their production and proven reserves by double-digit rates. And the stock's down like year to date. It makes like no sense. And the outlook for, they're primarily a natural gas producer, but the outlook for their commodities that they sell is really strong. So it's hard to believe. It's just been a negative dark cloud hanging over the energy sector from the Wall Street standpoint for quite some time. So there's a myth out there that these countries need $80 or $100 oil to make money. And that is totally false. They have all made money during the first half of the year. They're going to make a lot more money in the second half of the year. And their realized prices have been, most of them, averaging in the low 50s for oil. you know, and gas and NGL prices are definitely on the uptick going into the end of the year.
You know, I want to raise another factor that's going to come into play in the next decade, especially when we're looking at higher oil prices. We talked about the maritime law that goes into effect, about sulfur standards for ships. We talked about Iranian oil, and we also talked about the decline in Venezuela. I want to throw in a fourth factor in there, and that is the decline in investment spending by Western oil companies. Instead of raising spending on capital investments, they're using it to pay down debt. They're launching share buybacks. They're increasing dividends. But Wall Street does not like when any company says, you know what, we're going to spend money and drill and try to find more oil. That's not what is driving price. So down the road in the next decade, what's going to happen to production if these companies don't replace what they're producing with new discoveries?
Yeah, that's a big problem. And IEA has raised that problem, and I definitely see it. And they focus on OPEC and Russia and the United States. Outside of those three, the other is like 40% of the world supply. And nobody ever talks about the other. And the other is on decline. And so you got to make up for that decline, plus make up for growth in demand, which goes up 1.5 million barrels a day per year, year after year after year. And so you reach the point where demand meets supply. I mean, demand cannot exceed supply for very long before you eat up all your inventory. So you got this point where you have to start rationing fuels by price. I mean, that's just what's got to happen. It's the only way.
All right. Well, listen, Dan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, tell them how they could do so.
Yeah, they can first just go to our website, which is energyperspectives.com. Just kind of check out what we do. We file independent reports on publicly traded small and mid-cap companies and some of these midstream companies. If they'd like to join, they can either send an email to Sabrina. She handles membership services. And her email is just energyperspectives@gmail.com. That's energyperspectives, one word, @gmail.com.
All right, Dan. Well, listen, thanks for joining us on the program and keeping us up to date. I'm in your camp. I think energy prices are heading higher, and I think these machines and traders are missing the bigger picture here. Thanks so much, and have a great weekend.
All right, man. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And coming up in hour two, Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray is still looking for a final washout. Was Friday a fake out or a breakout? Also, are the internals of the market getting weaker? By the end of the year, we expect to hit 2850. Listen to find out why. Also, rising oil prices and what is occurring in emerging markets. Does that situation create the next financial crisis? Also, Dan Steffens from Energy Prospectus and the oil markets. Are we facing higher oil prices? Don't forget, sanctions against Iran take place on November 4th. What impact will that have? All of that's coming up in Hour 2 of the Financial Sense News Hour.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.